up? Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of The Wonder Podcast. This is the podcast where we break down movies all in one take. I'm Austin Archer. With me, as always, is my childhood next-door neighbor and lifelong best friend,
Kramer England.
What's up, dude?
Not much. How about you?
Dude, I'm chilling. Should we just really quickly, we're going to be saying this name a lot on the episode. Yes. Should we just say it three times really quick to make sure that we're safe?
Let's do it.
Beetlejuice. Did anything happen over on your end?
No. I mean, right. You know, Michael Keaton's sitting over there, but...
Michael Keaton's in your house.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whoa, weird. That's crazy, because I've got the guy that plays the dad from the first one.
Oh, that's not a bad one.
Yeah, and... you are a criminal.
Yeah,
sir, please.
Please leave my house.
Please leave my house. I loved you in Ferris Bueller, and I'm actually uncomfortable with you being here.
Yes, please leave.
Please leave. He did bad stuff.
Yeah, I don't, you know, I heard, I didn't look into it, but I'm like, that's not, no.
His stuff is bad. He did bad things.
Yeah, I don't doubt it. Yeah.
We don't need to get into it, but he did bad things. And I actually even, he did bad enough things that I was like, even the way that they incorporated him into Beetlejuice, I was like, I think you guys could have just not even... Like,
I kind of thought that too. Did he really even need to be? I mean, his head was bitten off by a shark, and so he couldn't see anything, which is, it was kind of like, it was funny.
It was fun.
But it was almost like it's a slap in the face without a face. So, but even still, I was kind of like, do you even need to do that? I don't know. I don't think you do.
Yeah. okay. So. The Beetlejuice cinematic universe is now a thing. We did an episode on the Twister cinematic universe. We are now in the BCU, the Beetlejuice cinematic universe. Everything these days is getting a legacy sequel, and here we are.
It really is. Yeah.
I think that it's important to let our audience know that we watched Beetlejuice and Beetlejuice for this episode. But we're mostly primarily going to focus on the plot of Beetlejuice.
Yes.
For the purposes of our conversation today.
Yeah.
Okay. So you know the movie from, I think it's the late 80s.
88.
88, the year that we were born, or the year that I was born. Are you 87?
I was 87.
87. I was born in 88. Michael Keaton plays a bio-exorcist named Beetlejuice who is like hired by two ghosts to get a family out of the house that the ghost died. These people move into their house. They want to get the people out. They hire Beetlejuice to scare the people out. Winona Ryder is their emo little goth kid who makes friends with the ghosts. You've seen the movie.
Yeah.
Michael Keaton's great as this character. I'd say in both movies, he's the thing that works for me.
Yeah, you know? he's the driving force behind both of the movies, especially the first one, and actually even more so in the second one.
Yeah, I think I watched the first one today, and I watched Beetlejuice earlier this week, and watching the first one, I was like, I don't know that I ever. I gotta be honest. I don't know that I ever really got it. I don't think I've ever, even as a kid, I know I watched this movie a lot growing up and I wanted to get it.
Yeah.
And I just don't think I ever really got it.
You know, I kind of feel the same way. The funny thing is, like, I remember watching it as a kid, or I remember wanting to watch it as a kid, like seeing pieces of it. And then when I watched it, I was like, I it was too hyped up in my mind.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know, but I mean, I think I do like it. I appreciate it more now that I watched it a second time. Like I think I watched it last Saturday. It's not the best movie, but this is the nice thing that I need to remember about both of these movies. They're not trying to be great. They're kind of trying to be funny and weird and show off Tim Burton's unique style, especially his production design.
I think that's
effects, which I can appreciate.
That's what I was thinking. I was like, what made this movie a classic and what made this movie a top pick in the filmography of Tim Burton? Which really, one of these days, we just got to talk about like how massive that guy's filmography has truly gotten over the last 40 years. Like, he has made so many movies. It's kind of crazy. This is definitely like one of the, if you were to ask most people what's top 10 Tim Burton movies, this would be in there. It's definitely part of that era of Tim Burton films with Edward Scissorhands and the first two Batman movies.
Yeah.
And that's when all of this was going on, when the world was first getting introduced to the aesthetic and the imagination of Tim Burton. This, especially the first movie, is very vintage Tim Burton. Like, it's just, there's so much, you know, 80s and 90s Tim Burton imagery in there. Right. And I think that's what this movie, both movies kind of exist on, is production design and character design.
Yeah.
But as far as like the story of these movies, or like the internal logic of the story, or the rules of the world, I never was really able to put it together of like, what are we doing here? Why is any of this? And you're right. It's not trying to be a great, amazing movie. It's just trying to be fun.
Yeah. And the movie is very, the story of the movie is very, very thin in both cases. The first one, probably even more so. The story is extremely thin, just enough to get by. And then the second one, they definitely focused on the story more, but there was almost too much story.
Oh, yeah.
In my opinion. Like, they needed to cut something out.
We got way too many characters and way too many plot lines.
Too many things going on. Yeah.
Yeah. It genuinely is twice the Beetlejuice. It's Beetlejuice.
Yeah.
So the promise of the title is, as much plot as you got, you're going to get at least twice as much. I think we got like 4 or 5 times as much plot, though.
I agree. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think we got more, probably more than we needed, just like we've been talking about. But
yeah. So, you know, I think that I can see why people, I was sitting next to people in the theater for Beetlejuice, who were like, they were having a great time.
Yes.
And they seemed like Beetlejuice heads. Like, they seemed like people who are like big fans of the BCU, of the Beetlejuice cinematic universe. And they were dying at every single joke. And I was like, okay, I'm not sure I'm as big of a Beetlejuice head as these people are, but
you know, and it was interesting when I was in my theater, there was a lot of people there. And there was like a family close, and a lot of the kids were laughing. And I was like, okay, that's interesting. I didn't think it was that funny, but it was, they were enjoying it. So, you know, I'm happy with that. If they're enjoying it, it's always better in a theater. So, but yeah, I kind of remember with you, some of the people were laughing and I was like, I didn't think it was that funny.
But I think that there are people, I think what I have to come to terms with at some point is that I'm just launching at the top of the show here with like piping hot take. I think that like in general, what you said about being like, it was more hyped up in my head, and then I rewatched it and it was like, that wasn't as big as as cool as I thought it was, maybe. I think that's in general how Tim Burton kind of goes for me. Is my memory of Tim Burton films growing up is more extravagant and cool and grand and weird than when I sit down to actually rewatch it. And that's sort of how Beetlejuice has been for me my whole life. Like, anytime growing up, Beetlejuice would be on TNT or TBS, I would sit down and be like, oh yeah, Beetlejuice. And then I'd start watching it and I'd be like, this movie's okay, I guess. You know, like, in my brain, it was like a cooler movie than, and I think there's a lot of that with Tim Burton, where like the aesthetic of it and the weirdness of it and the idiosyncrasies of it are what stand out to me. And then I sit down to rewatch the movies and it's like, honestly, in the filmography, the only movies that really get to me consistently on an emotional level are like Big Fish and Edward Scissorhands. And I do enjoy, I have a good time watching both Batman movies anytime I watch them.
Yes. It's funny you say that, because I feel the same way. I actually feel like Big Fish is his best movie, probably, in my opinion. Because it uses what he does so well, which is the extravagance of the stories.
Mm-hmm.
And then he grounds it so much in reality when you come back, and it's a drama.
Yeah.
And he does that drama so well in that it for that movie. So it's kind of like, it's a little less Tim Burton-y than usual, but in the best way. So, but then Batman, I mean, I'm a huge Batman fan, as you can see right there.
Yeah.
So and he did a great job on that, which, funny enough, so they did Beetlejuice.
Mm-hmm.
They made Beetlejuice, and then Tim Burton and Michael Keaton decided to make Batman. And I, you know, thinking about that time, living in that time, they didn't have the internet, you know, and they didn't have all that. And people were still mad at that casting.
Of course. What a weird choice to tell people that you're the guy that was just Beetlejuice. He's going to be Batman in a movie that features the Joker, but he's not playing the Joker. You'd think it'd be a shoo-in that it's like, oh, Beetlejuice to the Joker is like pretty much... It's you don't even have to change the makeup that much. Like you could just do almost the exact same character design.
And actually he would have been a great Joker.
Would have been a fantastic Joker.
It would have been great.
You know, that's something that I think you and I have talked about that we can hint to the audience coming up. Stay tuned. We might do a little Joker mania as we come into Joker Folie à Deux. Yeah. We might break down Folie à Deux. We might break down our favorite cinematic Jokers. Stay tuned for that. But yeah, you would think watching Beetlejuice that like, okay, if this guy's gonna play anybody in a Batman movie, it's gonna be some outlandish rogue. Mm-hmm. He's gonna be the Riddler. He's gonna be the joke. You know, he's gonna like not Batman.
Yeah.
I recently watched Batman Returns. I can't remember why. But I just got the itch to, and I was like, I love this movie. I think Batman Returns is so awesome. I love that Tim Burton gets permission to go full tilt Tim Burton and just be like, I'm going wild with this one. Like we're going, you know, like
I'm going to have to watch it again. I haven't watched it in years, but yeah, I got to watch it again.
It's very,
I remember not loving it. I just don't love it as much, but
when
I got to give it another chance.
When you just watch it as just like almost even letting go of 1989 Batman and just watch it as a standalone, like, like Tim Burton's take, like a gothic opera of a Batman story.
Right.
It's a blast. Character design, production design. The production design is amazing. The Gotham City in Batman Returns is awesome. The Penguin design is awesome. Michelle Pfeiffer as Catwoman is awesome. Like it's a really fun movie.
There are a lot of things that are stand out a lot about that movie.
Yeah,
so I got to give it another chance. I think the last time I saw it, I liked it better than what I had originally thought. So I probably like it even more this time. But anyway, we'll get into Beetlejuice now.
Yeah. So right off the bat, I got to say, in the theater, I do like, and we talked about this in our Signs episode. We never know which order these episodes are coming out, but I do like an extended title sequence. I like a nice long old fashioned title sequence where they play the score of the movie and they, you know, but.
Yeah, this one was good. It was very similar to Beetlejuice.
It's pretty much the exact same title sequence.
You go through the city or you go through this little town and then it kind of turns into the model that Alec Baldwin's character had made in the first film. And this was actually interesting. Did you notice this? I noticed this. When you go over first of all, you see the bridge where the Gina Davis and Alec Baldwin die, and you see them down kind of in the ditch.
Yeah.
Like there. Did you see that?
I saw them.
I thought that was kind of a fun little thing. It was kind of down in the corner. Then it goes up to the house.
Having watched Beetlejuice today, I was surprised that the title sequence in Beetlejuice is actually shorter than the title sequence. That was one thing is like the title sequence in Beetlejuice kind of goes on for a while. Like it was lengthy. Yeah. And I think it was, I'd have to go and time it, but watching Beetlejuice today, I was like, I think that the one in the sequel was twice as long. And I think this is sort of a theme for the movie overall is it's like, since it's a sequel, we're doing what we did in the first one, but just more of it, you know? and sometimes that's a good thing. Sometimes more of a fun thing is good. I think more, I don't even know that we get more Beetlejuice necessarily in this movie. Like,
no, we don't. Actually, Michael Keaton was pretty adamant that his screen time be reduced because he didn't want to be featured so much, because that's how it is in the first one.
Yeah.
I mean, he really doesn't show up until the midpoint.
Like, it's one of my problems with that movie, though, is it's called Beetlejuice, and every scene he's in is like, oh, this is a very fun character. But then it's like, he's just not in the movie enough.
I totally agree. I see what you're saying. But then again, the other side, or the other half that I feel, is like, it's a great character because you always want more. You'd rather want more of something than be like, God, get this guy off of the camera. Like, he's just so annoying.
Yeah,
that's the positive of it.
It is. It's kind of like Heath Ledger's Joker. It's like every time he's there, the movie is singing and coming to life, but you sort of want to be left wanting more of him. By the end of the movie, you're like, man, I could have used two or three more scenes with that character, but that's good. That's a good thing. And so I'll take that argument. Yeah. And I do think that, like, I was worried that because it was a sequel, because it was Beetlejuice, they were going to it was going to be too much Beetlejuice. And I actually feel like having watched the first one today, I was like, I think if anything, he's even, and because he was a younger man, he's more energetic and more over all off the wall in the first one than he is in the sequel.
I agree. He would have been a little crazier in the second one.
Yeah, it was sort of reserved. I was like,
yeah, it was. But I mean, again, he's the best part of the movie. He was really funny. So, but yeah, I agree. I totally agree.
Yeah. So we get through our very long title sequence, which I enjoy, but I don't know that it needed to be quite as long as it was. And
I guess we should say spoilers. We're going to
spoilers. Sorry. This is our show. We spoil every time we talk about a movie, we spoil. So we're spoiling Beetlejuice today and Beetlejuice.
yeah.
I feel so silly saying these, but we find a fully grown adult Winona Ryder as Lydia Deetz, who now has her own TV show where it's a paranormal show, like Crossing Over with John Edwards, where she talks to the dead. You know, Lydia Deetz was the only character in the first one who was able to see Alec Baldwin and Gina Davis. And that carries over into this movie. She's got a gift for seeing dead people. And she's sort of in a way become everything that the teenage version of her would have despised growing up. She's sort of a sellout who has used her gift of, and again, the first movie doesn't really make a big meal out of the fact that she has the ability to see Alec Baldwin and Gina Davis. It never really, they're not like, oh wow, you're special. She just like can see them and no one else can, and they're like, oh okay, and they're just friends. Yeah. This movie seems to be more like, no, it's a special thing that she has that nobody else has.
Yeah, and they tell us pretty early on that she could only, they made it more special because her ex-husband, the father of
Jenna Ortega,
he died, and Winona Ryder cannot see him. And they made that a big point.
The movie doesn't pay it off at all.
Not really. And we'll get into that. That was a little, it didn't really pay off. And it actually, it didn't work that well.
So we got Lydia Deetz in a relationship with Justin Theroux as this character who is one of the characters in the movie that I just thought, you can fully get rid of this guy and it'll be a better movie for it. I don't need this storyline at all.
You can either get rid of him or make him even crazier, because I feel like they were way too reserved with him.
Totally.
Like, make him, because Justin Theroux is actually really funny.
Yeah.
He's like, he can be really funny, and I feel like they, like when it is revealed in the end where he's like, I'm doing this all for the money, like I didn't really get that sense. Like I don't know, they could have turned him up to 11 and it would have made him at least more enjoyable, because he's pretty flat the whole movie.
I'm trying to think of who's the actor that what's his name, the actor.
So Otho. Is that who you're thinking of?
Who,
in the first movie?
Yeah,
Otho.
How did you know who I was thinking of?
Glenn Shaddix? I don't know.
Yes, Glenn Shaddix. How did you know who I was thinking of?
Because his character was kind of based off of Otho.
Yes.
So
yes.
Justin Theroux was kind of based off of Otho.
That's what's so weird, is it's like Lydia's married to a guy who's basically this movie's version of Glenn Shaddix from from the first movie. And I'm just like, this is the problem with the Lydia Justin Theroux relationship for me, is at no point in the runtime of Beetlejuice did I buy or was I given a reason why Lydia Deetz would be in a relationship with this guy. Other than the fact that, like, we do find out, spoiler, we find out that he has manipulated his way into this relationship. He went to a grieving, you know, people who have been, you know, people who, a grieving support group for people who have lost spouses and loved ones, and he met Lydia there and pretended to be a widower himself so that they could, you know, so that he could date her, and he lied about that.
Yeah,
but it's like, we find that out at the end of the movie, like, he's manipulated his way into this relationship, but I don't really see anything from her that's like, okay, cool, you were vulnerable emotionally, but like, how are you still dating this guy? How are you still in a, is there anything about him that we can latch into as to why the two of you would be together? What is holding her in this relationship other than that the screenplay tells us she is in the, you know?
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And again, if you're going to have a character like that, turn him up to 11, make him really like, accentuate him so that there's a reason that he's there, because the movie doesn't, it's not a big, I mean, it's more about the comedy and the zaniness of the story. So make him more zany, like make him more interesting, because he's Justin Theroux is giving it his best, and he probably did better than some could, but that really wasn't, there was just not much there.
I agree with you. If you're gonna have that character there, we need more from him. We need more for him to do comedically. We also need more of, like, maybe show a little bit more of that underbelly of who he really is, and that, like, Jenna Ortega's character, like, sees that. They hint at it in the movie, but I'm like, you can go further with that. You can, you know, maybe let the audience in on the information earlier that, like, he's a con man. He's a fraud. And then we know something that the characters on screen don't, and that creates some kind of tension or dynamic. The way it was played in the movie, all it really does while I'm watching it is the whole movie I'm going, why this character? Yeah. I don't buy the relationship between him and Lydia. He asks her to marry him and she agrees, and I don't know why. I don't know why she says yes in that moment and she doesn't just go, no.
I don't really get it either. And you know, in the beginning of this movie, she is on her show, and then she goes into the bathroom because she sees Beetlejuice in the audience, and then she starts taking these pills.
Yeah,
and I don't know. I didn't really get the point of that, but I was wondering if that was like not making her who she really was. But then again, he didn't want her to have the pill, so it didn't really make sense. And also, he probably didn't even need it. So
exactly, you could have done something where Justin Theroux is insisting on the medication, and the medication is, it takes away her ability to see dead people or something. I don't know.
You could have made something with that.
Yeah, I'm not really sure how the movie's trying to play it. This is the problem of Beetlejuice. It's what we said at the outset, too much stuff going on.
Yeah.
The inciting incident that sort of sets the whole plot in motion is the father from the first movie, played by the guy who plays, you know, Ed Rooney in Ferris Bueller.
Yeah, Jeffrey Jones.
Is that his name? Jeffrey Jones?
Jeffrey Jones, yeah.
Yeah, so he's a canceled actor. That's why he's not in the movie. He did some bad stuff. You can look up what he did. But he dies. We do this like kind of fun Tim Burton exclamation sequence where we see him dying.
I thought that was funny. His head gets bit off by a shark.
Yeah.
He's a plane crash, and then his head gets bit off by a shark.
Yeah. And it calls back the family to the town where they lived in this house with the ghosts of Alec Baldwin and Gina Davis in the first movie. So with Catherine O'Hara and Winona Ryder and her daughter Jenna Ortega all go back to this town for the funeral, and that's sort of what brings them all back to the events of
And so they all come back to the town, but right before that happens, before they even get into the town, we meet kind of one of the other antagonists. I guess it's really the main antagonist.
I should say that the guy dying is what sets the plot in motion in the living world. They're like these dueling plots. There's a plot that's going on in the world of the living, and then there's this other, like two other plots that are happening in the world of the dead. So
Catherine O'Hara's character has a a graffiti artist coming, and he falls down a well, an open manhole cover, and he dies. He goes in, and we see someone telling him to go down to the hall to the left, who it turns out to be Danny DeVito.
Yeah.
And he's like drinking turpentine or something. I don't know.
Drinking Drano or Drano something. I don't know what he was. But we're back in this world that was, I think the production designer from the first movie is Frank Walsh, maybe, or, but we're back in this sort of afterlife world from the first movie. That's really fun. I like the design of this place. Again, you can't really think too much about the rules of this place. It doesn't really hold together when you try to put some kind of internal logic to it. You just have to go with the fun of it. That like everybody yes. looks the way that they looked in the moment of their death. Yeah. I never quite know, again, the rules of it. I'm like, so the blue people, like, you know, when the football players are blue in the first movie, I'm like, did they all die and turn blue before? Like,
yeah, yeah.
Danny DeVito's character is blue. Like, did he drink Drano and turn the color of the Drano? Like, I don't.
Yeah.
You know, whatever. And, yeah.
But this is like, you know what? Hey, this is crazy. We're just going to run with it. It's not going to make much sense, which I enjoy when it's like, we're just going to do it because we can.
Yeah.
And in this scene, he's drinking that. And then he sees Monica Bellucci, who starts putting herself together, which was kind of a,
she comes out of all these different suitcases, and it's like a leg and an arm and half of her face. And she staples her own body back together with a staple gun. And that was a fun sequence.
That was a fun sequence. And I've seen this on, I kind of read up, people noticed this. So her wedding finger is missing. And in the first movie, in the wedding sequence, remember, she's like, where do you have the rings?
Correct.
And he takes out, he's like, oh, the ring. He takes out a finger that has a ring on it. And everybody's saying that was her finger, which I thought was really cool. Like, oh, that's fun. I didn't even notice. Like, that's a great little. But anyway, she staples herself back together. She goes up to Danny DeVito and she sucks out something. And he basically just, like, I don't even know. Like, all the air goes out of it.
Yeah, this is a fun little effect. She's like a soul sucker. She sucks the souls out of already dead beings. And I guess it's like, you know, second death. It's like actual death. Like, she has the ability to, you know, kill already dead things and send them to wherever the next level of whatever that is. We don't know.
Yeah.
But it's a fun little practical effect where they'll do like a dummy of that actor, and then it's almost like a bag of that actor, and they suck all the air out of the bag, and it's fun. It's
squished down.
Yeah. It kind of reminds me of the guy from the first movie who's been flattened by a car. Who's like,
he's hanging around. How do I live?
I'm feeling kind of flat.
so dumb.
Yeah. And that's, you know, but she says, where is Beetlejuice? So we know this woman who just stapled herself together, who's a soul sucker, is looking for Beetlejuice. This is a major plot hole of this movie. And again, if you think too much about internal logic in either of the Beetlejuice movies, it's not hard at all to poke holes in the rules of the rules don't seem to make sense. Why? I just don't understand how she's not aware that she can summon him by just saying his name three times.
Yeah, yeah, and that, you know, I don't, maybe because she's dead, but I
but
know.
They but later in the movie, Catherine O'Hara says his name three times in the afterlife and summons him. And so, and again, this is a weird thing, is like, they say in the first movie that the way to bring him back, the way to sort of resurrect him and bring him into the world of the living, is to say his name three times. They say that, they don't ever say the way to send him back is to say his name three times again. They just do that in the movie. They're like, Beetlejuice, 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 and they send him back. Yeah. But I'm like, cool, they didn't really establish that rule, but okay, whatever. And then it's also like how in the first movie, like Gina Davis and Alec Baldwin, the first time they say Beetlejuice three times, they go into the model and meet him. And that's how it works that time. Then they say home, home, home to go home. No one ever told them the rule about saying, it's just sort of like both movies have this stuff where I'm like, okay, what does saying Beetlejuice do? Because does it take you into where he is, or does it bring him out to where you are? And it does both things in both movies. And also, Catherine O'Hara in the afterlife says Beetlejuice three times, and he shows up where she is. And it's like, okay, does it just make him come to wherever you are? Whether that's,
I honestly, I did. Oh, you know what? This could be what it is. So the Gina Davis and Alec Baldwin say Beetlejuice three times, and then they go to where he is because they're ghosts. But if a living person says Beetlejuice, no, that doesn't work either, because Justin Theroux says his name and then they go down. So never mind. It's not. It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, I just...
I guess you just have to give into it, like, whatever.
It's like, this is... It's like one of these... Do we know who created the concept of the character Beetlejuice and, like, the rules of the... Because it feels like...
the original writers... Yeah, the original writers, Michael McDowell and Warren Scarron, I think they kind of came up with it, and then I don't know. I'm sure that there's more to the story of what happened, because... I read this thing on, like, Tim Burton got the script for the original Beetlejuice and gave it to Michael Keaton. And Michael Keaton was like, oh, I don't know, this guy doesn't really have much character. But then he kind of molded the character and made him who he is now. Mm-hmm. It's almost like Johnny Depp and Jack Sparrow. Like,
yeah.
The character was one way, but then the actor made him another way and really added a lot of the character to it. So I think Michael Keaton ultimately... kind of gave this made this character what he is now.
That's fun.
So I think, yeah, he might get the most credit.
It just sort of seems like, you know, it's kind of like one of those things like in Deadpool and Wolverine where they're like, hey, we need a convention to get these two together post Logan. So they create the idea of the anchor being in every timeline. But that's, it just is a rule that the movie is introducing that immediately has problems where you're like, well, that doesn't make any sense. Every person dies. So any timeline's anchor being like is going to die at some point. And you're saying that that makes the timeline disintegrate. Like, but that doesn't make any sense. Like, cause like whoever the anchor, if the anchor being is alive right now, that means they were born sometime in the last 100 years, unless they're Logan, who's maybe like 300 years old, but still he was born. It's a rule that immediately if you think about it too much, you're like, well, that, and that's what it seems like they've designed a lot of rules for how Beetlejuice works and how Beetlejuice functions in the story. But none of the rules really make sense if you hold them under a microscope or even just like scrutinize them a little bit.
Well, it's a lot like a pitch meeting. Hey, shut up. So let's go on.
Yeah, totally. And it's just sort of like, it just feels like it's just like saying Beetlejuice three times is how you get Beetlejuice.
Somehow.
We don't know why. Yeah. And neither movie ever really does much to, like, in this movie, we get a little bit of expanded lore on Beetlejuice. We find he does mention it in the first movie that he lived through the Black Plague. He talks about that briefly in a throwaway line. In this movie, we actually get to see him as a living person. And he marries Monica Bellucci as a living human being. And she finds out she's in some kind of soul-sucking cult. She kills him on their wedding night.
Well, and then she poisons him. And then I think he grabs the axe and chops her up. So they both died at the same time.
And I guess the plan is to suck his soul and then she gets to live forever. And I don't know the rules of that. That, like, I guess in her cult, you have to like suck the soul of your spouse.
Maybe.
The movie doesn't really explain this, but again, my point is like, we're getting more Beetlejuice lore, but we're still never figuring out, like, hey, why is Beetlejuice the way that he is in the afterlife? Why isn't he just a normal dead guy? Why is he like a special kind of dead guy who has a weird name that if you say it three times, you summon him and he's got all these powers? And the answer is just because he's Beetlejuice. Yeah. Okay. And this movie's Beetlejuice and we are going to get crazy with Beetlejuice. And like, that's the answer.
Yeah, that is the answer. And honestly, it's like, whatever. I don't mind the Beetlejuice. It's all the characters around him that make it worse. Like Monica Bellucci, I really like her. And I like her character in this movie. And I like the fact that he is scared of her.
Mm-hmm.
But I honestly feel like, okay, if you take her out of the movie, it still kind of works. And it might actually work better.
Again, totally. We can absolutely lose. Easy fix here. So Willem Dafoe is in this movie. He plays, and I like this character. He plays a dead actor who played a cop on TV, and in the afterlife he's an actual cop who like runs a detective agency who deals with, you know, afterlife crimes and things like that. And so he's like this former actor who used to pretend to be a cop, who now in the afterlife actually gets to be a cop. An easy fix, let's just say that like Beetlejuice in the afterlife is on the run from the afterlife fuzz for like fraud. Like he's been, he's wanted for different charges. And the afterlife plot is that Willem Dafoe's character is hot on his trail and Beetlejuice needs to find some people to get him out of the afterlife so that he can escape the, you know,
escape the fuzz. And then that would be great because I did like the fact that the daughter gets pulled in, and in order to save her, Winona Ryder has to agree to marry Beetlejuice. So that would actually go into it, why that those two would intersect.
But also, again, like one of my big problems about Beetlejuice is how many story beats, and this is my problem with so many legacy sequels, is when we just repeat story beats from the original movie, because that's exactly the climax of the original movie is Winona Ryder wants Beetlejuice to help Alec Baldwin and Gina Davis, and he says, "I'll only do it if you agree to marry me." And it's the exact same thing in Beetlejuice. She's like, "Hey, you need to help my daughter," and he's like, "Agree to marry me." And it's like, sure, you know. And she just kind of, in both movies, she just sort of like weasels out of it. She's just like, "Nah, I don't have to." And it's like, okay. And
they, you know,
but like, let's see if we can actually just lay out all of the different plots in Beetlejuice.
Okay. Well, the first plot, I guess, is that the dad dies, so the family gets back together.
Yeah.
And then Justin Theroux proposes to Winona Ryder.
And they're going to get married on Halloween night, which is like that weekend.
Which is like 2 days away.
So they're staying in town to get married in her hometown on Halloween night. That's sort of why the family is in the town.
Yeah. And they're trying, she's kind of trying to get out of it, but also kind of not trying to get out. Well, and her daughters wants her to get out of it.
Her daughter's mad at her because her daughter doesn't believe that she can actually see ghosts. She's got this TV show. So this is maybe another, this is like maybe the subplot of the human plot. She's got to deal with the fact that her daughter hates her because she claims to be able to see dead people, but she can't see her dead husband, her daughter's dad. And she's like, if you can see ghosts, how come you can't see dad? I think this is an interesting concept that Lydia Deetz can see the dead, but for whatever reason, she can't see her deceased husband. And you would think that the screenplay would want to answer the question of why this is. Like, why is it that she can't see her deceased husband? Are we going to get an answer to this? You feel like the movie's setting you up. And really, when we finally get to meet the dad in the afterlife, he's just like, "Oh, I've just been working over here. I've checked in on you guys from time to time." Like, I don't know. Yeah. It's just like,
yeah. And he's like, piranhas all over him.
And that's funny. It's funny. You know, it's a funny character design, but it's like, we don't get an answer to the setup.
It's a funny character design, but it also took away from any sort of emotion that I could have felt. Because they're just like moving around the whole time, which is, I don't know. Anyway, a little weird, but yeah. So that's the one plot. That's like the main plot. And then you get into, you know, the daughter is really mad. So she goes on a bike ride, crashes through a fence and crashes into a tree, and then meets a boy that she likes.
Yeah.
And he's like, "Oh, you like, how are you doing? Are you okay?" And then like she immediately creates a relationship with him and is attracted to him. And then he turns out, which I thought she had died, and I thought that would have been interesting because then the mom wouldn't know that she was dead, but she was dead. But that was not the case. She didn't die, but apparently the hit running into a tree made her see dead people. So
yeah, hitting her head on the tree. Yeah, I guess so. Interesting. I hadn't thought of that because I was like, why do they make such a meal out of her smacking her head on the tree if it's not going to do anything? But it is what allows her to see ghosts for the first time in her life. She sees this boy in a tree who turns out to be a ghost. I figured pretty early on in her relationship with this boy that he was a ghost. I was like, okay, this is going to... Yeah. Also, especially once we go into the house and we don't see his parents' faces, I was like, well, something's going on with those...
That was what did it for me. Yeah. Yep. Something's going on with those... I was like, the parents are dead. They're dead.
something's going on with those parents. And then if the parents are dead, so is he. And the fact that we go up into his room and she's like, wow, you've got a lot of 1990s vinyl and stuff like that. And he's like, she's like, it's so vintage. And he's like, yeah, vintage. Totally. Yeah. You know, we find out he's been dead since maybe like 5 years after the events of the first movie. And he's just been kind of living in his backyard. He's also, he also killed his parents. And so he's like a bad guy. He's a bad kid.
Again,
this is a plot I think that has some teeth, that is interesting. Yes. It just lives in a movie that doesn't have room for it. There's not enough space for it to be fully developed in an interesting way. He basically, the plot here is he's going to try to trick Lydia's daughter into trading her soul for his so that he can go back to being alive.
Yes. And he's trying to charm her. They do kiss, and he ultimately is trying to get her to switch bodies so that he can be resurrected or live again on Earth, kind of like Beetlejuice. So
yeah.
So they find out about this plot. The mom finds out that he is actually dead, and because she could see him in the window, because she can see dead people.
Yep.
But yeah, and ultimately that, you know, that's why she teams up with Beetlejuice. So that's another thread that they have. And then the ex-wife thread is the other plot point, that she is so wasted in this movie that, you know,
Beetlejuice has an ex-wife who is hunting through the afterlife for him in order to fulfill some kind of thing. She was some kind of ritual she was trying to do when they got married hundreds of years ago, where she has to suck his soul to live forever or something. She is going through, and we don't ever really get an answer to why she was chopped up into lots of pieces and put into different boxes. Is that because he hacked her up to kill her?
That's what they imply. That's what I took from it, because he chops the little statue in half.
But then I don't know who put her in the boxes and like hit her. I don't know. No. Maybe, I guess we could just say he did. Maybe. Beetlejuice just came and found the different pieces and put them in. I don't know.
Maybe the poison took a long time. I don't know.
Yeah.
This is the thing. Like, this is probably the thinnest part of the movie.
Yeah.
But this was also probably the parts that I loved the most about the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Because she is great. I mean, she kind of looks like a real life version of the Nightmare Before Christmas girl.
Yeah, she does.
With very Tim Burton. But so she was really interesting. I loved the weirdness of like when he's telling the story in Italian.
Uh-huh.
Of like how they met.
Yeah.
And like these weird sequences that they have, that was really funny. And then like when she, you know, Willem Dafoe as well, I thought he was really funny. And all the times that he's in it are when dealing with her. So it's like,
yeah, basically Willem Dafoe's plot is because Monica Bellucci 's been going through the afterlife hunting for Beetlejuice, she's sort of been on a afterlife killing spree, sucking souls out of people who she's interrogating. Willem Dafoe, being the afterlife detective, is on her trail, and being on her trail puts him onto Beetlejuice's trail, and he wants to go and interrogate Beetlejuice and say, how come this woman's looking for you, and all this stuff. This is the web that they're all entangled in. You know, part of me goes, hey, maybe we lose the dead boyfriend thing for Lydia's daughter. I don't know. Any one of these could work as a plot for a sequel. This could be the plot of the sequel. Is Lydia Deetz has a daughter who is mad at her because her dad's dead, and Lydia can't see her dad. And that's the conflict there. I buy that. They have to go home because the dad from the first movie dies. I buy that.
Mm-hmm.
Lydia's daughter makes friends with a ghost that she doesn't know is a ghost, and she also doesn't know as a killer who killed his parents. That's all interesting. She gets pulled into the afterlife as a ploy by this ghost. Lydia has to go into the afterlife and get her daughter back and seek the help of Beetlejuice once again to get her daughter back. That's a movie right there. We put in the Beetlejuice's wife and the Willem Dafoe stuff, and the Justin Theroux stuff, and we just got too many things competing for but you know, inversely, we can get rid of the daughter and the dead boyfriend thing, and we could just do a movie about how Lydia's got this daughter who kind of thinks she's a fraud, doesn't think that she's legitimate. When they go back home, Lydia decides, you know what, I'm gonna prove it to you. I'm gonna show you the afterlife. I'm going to draw a little chalk thing and I'm going to take you into the afterlife and let's see if we can find your dad. And they're, while they're on this quest, they run into Beetlejuice, who's running from his ex-wife, and they have this whole journey, you know, adventure in the afterlife or something. I don't know. The movie's just got to find a way to carve out more time for these different new characters and plot lines, because none of them seem to get enough space to breathe, in my opinion.
No, I agree. And there are funny things about each of the storylines, but they can't really live on their own. But that's the thing about the first movie that I did like. It was much more focused, because the Alec Baldwin and Gina Davis are just trying to get them out of the house. And that's so it. They use Beetlejuice, and he causes a lot of problems. He makes it worse off. So now they have to get rid of Beetlejuice. And this could have used a lot more simplicity for the overall movie. Now, having said that, there's still a lot of stuff that I just, when you kind of let go of it, you know, because the movie intentionally, you're not really supposed to think about it too much, even though it fell over its own plot.
Yeah.
There were still a lot of things that were pretty funny and I enjoyed about the movie. But everything together, it's you know, could have been even better than what it was. And so, sorry, go ahead.
No, I agree. Keep going.
I think that the parts that I liked were the funny parts and the practical effects. Like when Willem Dafoe shows the picture to Beetlejuice and his face goes into some claymation thing where his tongue sticks out, hilarious. Willem Dafoe always getting coffee from his assistant every time in every scene.
Yeah.
Really funny. When everybody gets sucked into the phones, really funny. All the production design. And the song at the end, really weird. And there's a few songs in the movie.
Okay, so this is something I want to talk about.
Okay.
So the musical number at the end, we once again, we ended a wedding, just like the first movie.
Yes.
Again, this is the Twisters syndrome, the legacy sequel thing where it's like, we're just basically trying to hit all the beats, be like, the first movie ended at a wedding. This one's going to end at a wedding. We had the sandworm in the first one. We're going to go to the sand, you know, like we got to hit all these different beats. We got to go to the waiting room with the waiting, with the ticket. We got to do all the things to be like, remember, this is Beetlejuice. But there's so many things in this movie that in the context of just the movie Beetlejuice, they're only there, feels to me like the only reason why they're there is to say, remember the first movie?
Yeah.
And that they don't have any narrative purpose. Like starting off with when we first go back to the town and we're at the funeral for the dad and they have a children's choir sing the Deo song.
Yeah.
And they sing a choral version of, you know, Deo, we said Deo, and it's a thing where I'm like going immediately. I'm going, wait a minute. Okay, I know that in the first movie, there's a very famous musical sequence where Gina Davis and Alec Baldwin possess all these people at a dinner, and they make them sing this song. But you're telling me that in the world of these films, that moment became such a seminal and important moment for this family that they're having a choir sing the song at the dad's funeral. Like, I just think that is like, it's such like sequel stuff where they're just like, the only reason why we have a choir singing this song at this funeral is because we want to reference the first movie. But I'm like, it makes no sense in the world of this movie that the Deo song has just become a very important song to this family. To the, like, the Dietz family is just like that. It is like their family anthem now, and they have a choir sing it. I just am like, why would that be the case? Why? And really just like, they're like, hey, everyone, remember the first movie? And it's like, yeah, I do, but you shouldn't be thinking of it as the first movie. It's just part of it's just a thing that happened in your life once. It's not like your life does not, the characters in this movie, your life does not consist of the first movie and this movie. You've had 40 years in between the movies, you know, of events and memories, but I don't know it. And then the movie does, like, the only reason why we have a musical number at the wedding at the end of the movie is because there's a musical number in the first movie. So it's like, we get to the end of the movie and it's like, well, in the first movie, we did a sequence where everyone gets possessed and sings a song. So we have to do that in this movie too. And it's like, or you don't, I'm totally fine if you do something else. I like do something that's similar to that, but not the exact same thing. I just always kind of, whenever a sequel is doing that, where they're just, where the only reason why a thing is happening in the movie is so that they can be like, remember, this is part of the DNA of these movies, is like, this scene has to happen. We gotta have it where everyone lip syncs a song. And it's like, I don't think that's a rule of the movie. I don't think you have to. I really,
you know, yeah. You know, this is, it's a very interesting thing with sequels, especially everything that you brought up is very, very valid. And we, you know, we did Romulus last week, and that movie does many things similar to that.
Yeah.
Like, you're doing it mainly to be like, hey guys, you remember this movie? Like, you remember what you did in this movie? Like, we're doing the same thing. And it's like, okay, great. The interesting thing about sequels is that they seem to work best when you do them quickly. So I know a lot of people don't like 2 years between a movie, but even if you have 4 years between a movie, that works really well because you're not so beholden to everything that everybody loved about that movie. Like, I'm thinking about the sequels that we grew up with, and it's like, you know, Batman, just since we talked about it. So like the Dark Knight trilogy,
right?
Like, Batman Begins and The Dark Knight, it's not just a rehash of everything that you saw before.
The Dark Knight's not just constantly going, hey, remember when we did this in Batman Begins?
Yeah.
If it was, we'd be like, yeah, I do. Move on with the movie.
Please keep going. Like, please. It's just out. So when you make a sequel and you make it quickly, relatively quickly, within the, you know, 5 years or something, it seems to work really well because...
Yeah, can you imagine?
Continue the story rather than just remaking the story.
Can you imagine if Dune Part 2 was just a bunch of like winks to the audience about Dune Part 1? It's just like, hey guys, remember in Dune Part 1 when we did this thing? It's like, yeah, keep going with the story, please. Like,
continue progressing
the story. Like, I remember that, but I don't want the characters in the movie to keep looking at me through the screen and being like, remember? I get that, like, Beetlejuice tonally is obviously very different from something that takes itself as seriously as Christopher Nolan's Dark Knight trilogy or the Dune movie trilogy that is happening right now from Denis Villeneuve. I get that. I just feel like, yeah, like Alien Romulus, it's like the only reason, in my opinion, to set that movie between Alien and Aliens is so that you can have a bunch of stuff in the movie that looks at the audience and goes, check that out. Nostromo, yeah. Dude. And I'm like, I'm like, yeah, cool. I know, you know, that's fine. Just do your own. Like, I get it. We're going to have xenomorphs and facehuggers in this movie. We're going to have Weyland-Yutani. We're going to have lots of stuff that tells us we're in an alien movie. I don't need to see this like bad digital version of Ian Holm, you know, and Beetlejuice is one of those sequels where it's like the movie has become so, there are so many images and moments from the original movie, 1988 Beetlejuice, that have become a part of culture that the sequel like almost feels like it has no choice but to reference all of them, including doing claymation, being like, hey, we're going to do claymation, don't worry, because that's a part of, you know, like, that's a part of the first movie. So we got to do some claymation in here. We're going to do practical effects. Like, all this stuff where I'm going, maybe if you want to have all of these different plots happening, the Beetlejuice ex-wife plot, the Willem Dafoe cop plot, the Jenna Ortega dating the kid who killed his parents plot, the Justin Theroux plot, maybe if we get rid of all of the hey remember references to the original movie, maybe that's how we free up some space in the runtime and also just make it its own film. Just go, this is going to be its own thing. Beetlejuice is going to be its own, you know, entity within the Beetlejuice cinematic universe. I don't know. I agree with you that like there are things that work. I liked the Willem Dafoe getting brought the coffee all the time. I think Michael Keaton is fun in the movie. I think that the Monica Bellucci character design is fun. I think the production design is fun. I like the practical effects. Overall, I just think watching both of these movies, I think I just was like, I'm not sure I'm a big Beetlejuice head. Yeah. I just don't think that like these movies tickle me the way that they do some viewers. I think I just kind of, my feeling at the end of them is just sort of like, okay. It's like,
yeah,
all right. Like the ending of Beetlejuice, I was like, what? Like, it just felt like the movie was like, I'm not sure how to end this one. So here's a weird scene and then the end. And like,
I know. And, you know, they have the musical sequence, which when I, you know, I the song is MacArthur Park.
Yeah.
And this, after the movie, I went and did some research. I mean, just looking it up online, right? Mm-hmm. And it's more funny to me now because that song, first of all, it was sung by Richard Harris, Harris, who is Dumbledore.
Wow.
The first Dumbledore.
I'll never have that recipe again.
Yes. Yeah. And I was like, this is so, why did they choose this song? Like, it doesn't make sense. When I went and researched it, like, it actually does make a lot more sense. The song is about a love that comes to an end, you know, and mm-hmm. like, someone left the cake out in the rain and the icing is melting because, and I'll never have that recipe again, which is kind of, you know, a metaphor for their relationship. Their, you know, relationship has gone downhill or whatever.
Right.
And I thought that was funny. And listening to the song and the guy who wrote the song was like, oh yeah, I love it. And, you know, Weird Al did a parody of the song and then Donna Summers did a disco version, which is in the end of the movie. Anyway, so it was weird when I was watching it, but now that I'm seeing it, I actually enjoyed it. I think it's a really funny song to choose because it is such a weird song. And then like the part when Willem Dafoe is like going through the graveyard and like rolling around, which is really funny. Like, I thought that they stopped playing that song, but that part of the song is actually part of the song.
Oh, wow.
Of MacArthur Park.
Wow.
So that actually made it funny. And then the fact, okay, now I'm going to take a total left turn here.
Okay.
The Simpsons.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Anytime I hear MacArthur Park, I think of The Simpsons.
I do, too. Yeah. First of all, I didn't even know that this was a famous song. MacArthur Park was a famous song.
Yeah.
And I realized, like, oh, my gosh, I'm still understanding pop references from The Simpsons.
Yeah.
Like, this happens
It's Apu's daughter. Apu's daughter in the talent show plays MacArthur Park on her bongo drum.
Yes. And and she's like, and I'll never have that recipe again. Oh, no. And like, I remember you and I having a conversation when we were kids after we watched that episode. And I was like, what is that song? And I think we were like, oh, I don't know. It's just a funny song that they made up.
Yeah.
And then realizing, no, that is an actual song that was like a number two hit.
Yeah.
And so I get a lot of knowledge from The Simpsons, which totally blows my mind.
Oh, The Simpsons is such a cultural reference point.
Oh, early days, especially.
Here's another interesting like sequel thing. Yeah. And this is a thing that happened long before Beetlejuice was made into a movie.
Yes.
It's sort of like the way that the lore or the idea of a film gets kind of retconned via culture. Mm-hmm. I think that anyone, if you tell them to picture Beetlejuice in their heads, like, what does Beetlejuice look like? He's got big, crazy green hair, and he's wearing a black and white striped suit, right?
Right.
Like, that's Beetlejuice.
Right.
And I think, you know, we were raised on, there was also a cartoon on TV of Beetlejuice, and like what Beetlejuice wore as the cartoon. And cartoons famously, like, they always wear the same outfit. Like, SpongeBob SquarePants wears the same outfit in every episode. The Simpsons, everybody wears the same clothes. Beetlejuice only wears the striped suit. So when we get to Beetlejuice, for the majority of the runtime of the movie, when we see Beetlejuice, he's wearing the black and white striped suit. He's wearing like the Beetlejuice costume. But when you actually sit down and watch the 1988 Beetlejuice movie, he wears the striped suit exactly one time in the movie, and it's for like 3 minutes. He's in the movie a lot, and he wears like, he has like 15 different costume changes in the movie, and just one of the costumes that he wears is the black and white striped suit, and he wears it in one sequence. And the rest of the movie, like, for a lot of the time, for his longest scenes in the movie, he's wearing like a Hawaiian shirt and a trench coat. And like, that's the Beetlejuice outfit, is he's just like a guy wearing like a Hawaiian shirt and a trench coat. And that's what he wears for most of his scenes. And what it becomes in the cultural lexicon is like, Beetlejuice is a guy with green hair who wears a black and white striped suit. Even though it's like, I don't know how we decided on that. That's just one of his costumes from the first movie. And then it became like the costume, like that just became, but there's nothing in the movie that says like, cause Beetlejuice is a character who can magically change his clothes anytime he wants. He like changes his clothes into Alec Baldwin's character. In the second movie, he turns into like a psychiatrist character for a scene. This is a thing that he does. He'll sort of become different characters by changing his clothes. Yeah. But I guess the assumption is that like his baseline clothes, his Beetlejuice clothes, is the black and white striped suit. But there's nothing in that first movie that actually suggests that. It just sort of became that in the cultural brain. And then in the second movie, they're like, indeed, these are the Beetlejuice clothes, is the black and white striped suit. But I'm like, that's actually not really established by that's such a nitpicky thing.
I think they had the poster has him in that suit.
Right.
The original poster has him in that suit. So I think it also kind of like, I don't know, it's very iconic now. But you're totally right. Like, everyone thinks that is his suit, but that's not what he wears the majority of the time. He wears, that other thing, the trench coat. Really,
it's almost like a Mandela effect thing, where it's like, it's like if he's
but he's not.
It's like if I told you to picture all of the scenes that Beetlejuice is in the 1988 movie Beetlejuice, it's like, what is he wearing? And it's like, he's wearing the black and white striped suit for at least 90% of it, right? It's like, no. He's wearing the black and white striped suit for maybe 5% of it. Like, and I just think that's an interesting thing of how the cultural concept of the character becomes the character. Just like you were saying, these screenwriters wrote a character, but then Michael Keaton sort of gave the character life. And then even this costume took on its own life in the cultural lexicon. That by the time we get to Beetlejuice, it's like, actually, this is what Beetlejuice looks like, is this. Yeah. And the movie just sort of decides, and it's like, okay. But again, that's just the movie sort of being self-referential of its own place in culture. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like, no, I totally agree.
Yeah.
The other thing that I forgot to mention, a couple things that I like. There's two things that I really like. The first one, Bob.
Yeah.
Really like Bob. I saw a theory as well online that there's a theory that Bob, the character of Bob in Beetlejuice, was the character of Bob in Batman.
Oh, interesting.
Like in the 89 Batman, which I thought was really funny. Anyway, Bob is a great character. Loved him. Really funny. Looks just really weird. Then the second thing, baby Beetlejuice. How did you feel about baby Beetlejuice?
Okay, here's my thoughts on Bob and baby Beetlejuice. Go ahead. So with Bob, again, this is a thing that like the kind of tag to the 1988 Beetlejuice movie is Beetlejuice is sitting in the waiting room in his wedding tuxedo. It's all covered in sand because he got eaten by a sandworm at the end of his wedding to Lydia. And he is sitting in between a man with a shrunken head and a kind of like tribal guy who like a African tribal head shrinker, voodoo guy. And Beetlejuice messes with that guy. He switches numbers with him. And that guy, as a punishment, sprinkles the head shrinking stuff on Beetlejuice and shrinks Beetlejuice's head down. And that's the end of the movie. So that's the only thing, is that like the 1988 movie ended with this little scene where Beetlejuice is sitting next to a guy with a shrunken head. Now in the second movie, Beetlejuice has a bunch of employees that work for his bioexorcism outfit, and they're all guys with shrunken heads. And I don't know why, except for the movie is referencing the first movie. And I don't, but I like in the internal logic of it, I'm like, wait, so wait, I'm sorry, where did he find, like, he was, the last time we saw him, he was with this guy. It just feels like the movie is just going, remember the first movie? Remember how he sat next to the guy with the shrunken head? Now he's working with a whole bunch of guys with shrunken heads. And I'm like, cool. Why though? Why? And I feel differently than you do. Cause I just look at it and go, I don't get the joke is just like, remember the first movie. And yeah. I'm like, yeah, but like, maybe if it was just the one guy, maybe if it was just like that guy that he was sitting next to on the couch became his best friend. And
would be good. Yeah,
I'm down with that. But the fact that he has a whole fleet of them, I'm like, well, who are all these guys? I don't, you know, like, it just is the movie being like, remember how there was a shrunken head guy? Now there's more of them. And I'm like, okay, why? Why are there more of them? And the movie's like, because remember? And I'm like, yeah, sure. And then the baby Beetlejuice thing, I just don't really need or care for. It sort of is reminiscent of like Chucky. It had a very like Chucky vibe.
It was something that was new.
It's new.
Kind of.
It's new. It's gross.
Reason I found it funny.
Yeah.
First of all, that scene when it comes was actually really funny. They go down and they see Beetlejuice and he's a therapist and she's like freaking out. And then Justin Theroux, which he was actually very funny. I thought the whole scene was funny. The reason I kind of like it is because it did seem like they were making fun of all the things that have become babies.
Oh, sure.
Baby Yoda. And yeah. There's a few other babies that are like, oh my goodness, the baby's so cute. And so then that's like, oh, let's do a baby Beetlejuice, but make him extremely ugly and like kind of horrific. So I actually thought that was pretty funny. And I was like, good for you guys for doing something original. Everything else is kind of just a throwback to the original movies. So.
Yeah, at least baby Beetlejuice is a new, it's pushing the world of the movie forward. And I can say that about Willem Dafoe's character, and I can say that about Monica Bellucci, and I can even say that about this plot with Lydia and her killer boyfriend.
Correct.
I just think that like at least those things are new things in the Beetlejuice world. I just wish the movie could balance them better. And yeah, I'm fine with baby Beetlejuice. That's fine. I don't really know that I have much more to say about the plot of Beetlejuice, or that we really need to.
No, I don't think we need to. She has a dream at the end.
She has a dream with baby Beetlejuice.
That her daughter gives birth to baby Beetlejuice. And then he wakes up. She wakes up and Beetlejuice is next to her. And then she wakes up again and he's not there. So I don't know if that was a hint to a sequel, but that's about the only thing that we need to say.
But, I don't know if we're going to get Beetlejuice. And I kind of personally don't really, I don't need it and I don't want it. But I guess the question is how well did Beetlejuice do at the box office? And that will kind of give us our answer. And if it crushed, then they'll probably make Beetlejuice. And if they do, I really hope that they can just make it in the next couple of years so they can do their own thing with it and not have to constantly be calling back to the first movie. Okay. Beetlejuice. Let's get into our rankings for the film. For everyone who's watching, we do several different rankings. We rank the movie on there's a technical ranking. That's basically just the filmmaking score, just cinematography, effects, acting, the musical score, the technical craft of making the film. We do a cultural relevance to the movie, just what do we think the cultural impact of this movie is going to be? We do the ending. How well did they stick the ending of the film? We do a rewatchability score, and we do a personal score, just our subjective personal score. How did we actually like it? So, let's get into this technical score. I don't think that's any surprise based on our conversation that I liked this movie less than you did. Technically is where I'm going to probably give it the highest ranking of the night. I'm going to give it a 6.5 technical score. I think that's mostly what this movie has going for it is the production design. I like the practical effects. Yeah. I like the makeup. That's all very fun. I could even go as high as a 7, potentially. I like hearing Danny Elfman's score. It's a very iconic musical score. I think Michael Keaton is doing a good job. I think most of the actors are doing their very best. I think Willem Dafoe's having fun in the movie. I'll go with a 7 technical score.
Yeah, that's what I gave it to, a 7. It feels appropriate. And everything you said, it's more for the actors, the production design, and the score was really great. Mm-hmm. And just kind of those weird zany things that they did that pulled off practically. But other than, I mean, the fact that there were so many storylines is what brings it down. I think, you know, 6.5 or 7, it's probably in there somewhere.
Yeah, it's losing points on the screenplay for just kind of too much plot and not balancing those different plot threads well enough or finding room for them for any one of them to really shine. Mm-hmm. Okay, how about the ending? How well do you feel like it stuck the ending? I'm going to say the ending for me is like a 5, like 5, because it's just sort of like, I'm not even going to go lower and say 4. I just was like, the ending of this movie to me felt like they were repeating the ending of the first movie. And then the actual ending, like the denouement after the climax, was just sort of like the movie didn't know when to just hit the credits. And I did not feel like this movie really came together. I felt like everything was like, hey, we read in this handbook that this is how we fix this. And everything, the characters were just sort of going, oh, well, you know, he literally injects Justin Theroux with a truth serum so that he'll say who his character really is. And he's like, well, this is who my character really has been all along. And that's the true nature of my character. And it just was like, I just thought the ending felt like a cop out and felt like the movie was running out of time to wrap up all of its various plots. And I'm going to say 4, low.
You know, I think that's very, very fair. I think I give it a 5.
Yeah.
For a lot of those same reasons. The other thing that I really did not like was when she finds her dad. Now, this movie doesn't have to be an emotional movie, but I feel like it was a complete missed opportunity to not have some sort of emotion and some sort of payoff. Like when the daughter actually gets to see her dad and say goodbye, they could have made it a little bit more emotional, whereas they just kind of made him like awkwardly sit around a table and then be like, oh, you know, she's a great kid. We did a great job, right? Like, yeah, we did. And then they like walk away and they give him a hug and then he lets him go. And I was like, that was a really big missed opportunity where you could have added a little bit of emotion and a little bit of like heart to the movie. So that could have been played up really well in addition to all of your things that you said. That's why I gave it.
Again, no payoff with the like the conflict between Jenna Ortega and Winona Ryder, who are arguably our two biggest, like, outside of Beetlejuice, those are our two biggest characters. Those are our two protagonists, really. And the conflict is that she's like, you can see all these dead people, but you can't see dad. Why is that? And she even says, I don't know why I can't see your father. That's mm-hmm. a big question that the screenplay can pay off in a nice way. And it doesn't do anything with it. And when we finally get to see the dad, it's just sort of like, oh, there he is. And he's like, eh, I'm just here. And he's like, I got piranhas on me. And they're like, oh, okay. And it's not emotional. They don't answer the, yeah. It just feels like, again, even the way that like they get rid of her killer boyfriend guy, it was like, and this plot is over now. Like, it just was like,
you're going down to hell or whatever.
Yeah, he just goes to hell, and that's the end of that plot. But it just sort of feels like that's how all the plot lines end, is they'll set something up. There'll be a question. There'll be like, oh, how are they going to deal with this? And the way it gets dealt with all of them, with his wife, even with Beetlejuice, with like, oh, how are you going to get out of marrying Beetlejuice? Everything's just sort of like, here's how. And they just sort of, everything just feels really rushed and doesn't feel like they pay it off or land anything in a satisfying way. So
too many storylines.
Yeah. So. Rewatchability for me, I'm going to put it even lower at a 3. I really think on rewatching even Beetlejuice, I find out that like this movie is hyped up more in my head than when I watch it. I just kind of go like, I just don't think I really care about the BCU. I just think I don't really care if I ever see Beetlejuice ever again. And I don't know if I'll watch a third movie if it comes out, to be honest.
That's fair. That's fair. Yeah. I don't, you know, I think I put it at a 5. I might have been a little generous in this one, but you know, I was able to rewatch Beetlejuice, and the very much superior film to Beetlejuice. Mm-hmm. This one, yeah, I think a 5, mainly because, like, if I watch it, I'm definitely going to not think about it at all. But watch it for some of those funnier scenes. But, yeah, I'm being generous, giving it a 5.
Okay, cultural impact. What is the cultural impact of Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice? And to me, again, I think that this is going to be a pretty forgettable entry into the Tim Burton filmography. I think this is a situation. You know what I didn't bring up is, like, this movie reminds me a lot of Ghostbusters Afterlife. And I think this is a similar situation to Ghostbusters. Did you see Ghostbusters Afterlife?
I did.
My problem with that movie was just way too many characters in this movie. During the third act climax, there's like 14 Ghostbusters who are all like fighting different ghosts on different levels of the fire station. And I was like, guys, in the first movie, it was 4 guys. It was just 4 of them. And we got like 14 different protagonistic characters all wrapping up their various different plot threads. And it just was like too much story. And in my brain, I'm going, honestly, I would have rather have just watched a movie about Bill Murray, Dan Aykroyd, and the guy who plays Winston. I can't remember his name, but like the three of them just being Ghostbusters in their 70s. I would have rather have just watched that movie. It's simpler.
Yeah.
But also it's really like as far as the cultural impact of Ghostbusters Afterlife and Ghostbusters Frozen Empire, I think ultimately they're just going to sort of fade into obscurity and people are just going to continue to remember Ghostbusters and Ghostbusters 2. And that's how I feel about Beetlejuice is I think that like Beetlejuice will continue to be the entry into the Burton filmography that people will point at. And Beetlejuice will just sort of be its like kind of forgettable legacy sequel that was made as a cash grab. And I don't think it's going to like have the staying power that Beetlejuice has had. So I'm going to put it at like a 3. Okay. Cultural relevance.
I think you're very valid points. I put it at a 6 simply because Tim Burton fans will always love anything that Tim Burton does.
True.
And the fact that especially with Wednesday, you know, him being involved in that, which actually I really liked the show Wednesday. I thought it was great. Everything he does has some sort of staying power. And I'd probably put the original Beetlejuice around like 7.5 or an 8.
Oh, sure. Because
of how influential all of his movies are and his style, just like everybody knows. So I'm putting it at a 6. Because of that fact that it will probably have an influence on some filmmakers or just some people anyway.
I'd give the original an 8 or an 8.5 as far as cultural staying power and cultural impact. Beetlejuice has become a kind of mainstay character that like people, it's recognizable across the world. Everybody knows what it is. Mm-hmm. It's definitely had staying power. I just don't know that Beetlejuice in like, you know, in a few generations that like, I don't know, you know, like I think the idea behind these movies like Ghostbusters Afterlife and Ghostbusters Frozen Empire is that it's Ghostbusters for a new generation, but I don't know that like the generation it's meant for, kids who are teenagers today and in their early 20s in like 10, 15 years are going to still be like, "Oh man, remember Ghostbusters Afterlife?"
The funny thing about these two with a lot of legacy sequels is the actual cultural impact, I feel like, lessens with the original movies because of the legacy sequels or the more bad sequels that you do.
Yeah.
It lessens, like The Matrix, we talked about a little bit.
Yeah.
It kind of lessens it a little bit. Like, sure. Oh, yeah, I mean, that one is amazing, but then
it dilutes it. Ones.
Yeah, so.
Because you have to contend with the fact that, like, the canon is bigger now. Whenever people just go like, "I don't recognize that movie as canon," I'm like, or people talk about their head canon, I'm like, cool, but like that's a cope. Like you're coping with the fact that like it is canon, like, and you can't get away from that. That it's like that's part of the story that you like now. They've made it officially part of it. So, you know, subjective score, no surprise here. My subjective score is low. I gave this on Letterboxd, like I think I gave it a 2, and I just didn't really care about this movie. I didn't hate it. I wasn't like, "Oh, I hate Beetlejuice." I just didn't care. Like, if I gave it a 2 on Letterboxd, I'll be nice and give it a 4 here. I'll say my subjective score is that's fine. You can have a four for the, you know, fun to see Michael Keaton back at it. Fun to see some practical effects, but really I don't really care for movies like this, and I don't care for this movie in particular, but I didn't like, I don't hate it. I just was like, whatever. I probably will never watch it. That's where I'm at.
Yeah. Yeah. I gave it a 5.5, mainly because some of the things you said, like, oh, it was fun to see Michael Keaton back doing that character. The production design was fun. The, some of the crazy things that they did were funny, but ultimately way too much going on, and also not crazy enough.
Yeah.
Could have made it crazier.
Yeah.
I wish they would have leaned into it more, which is a very strange thing for me to say, especially with a Tim Burton movie like this. So
it's kind of weird. Better. It's kind of weird to say too much and also not enough, because that is how it feels. It's like, I'm interested in all of these different plot lines and all of these new characters and all of these scenarios. I think all of them are like a nice angle to get us into a Beetlejuice sequel. It's just that I don't really get enough story from any of them. And I also want all of them to go bigger and swing, you know, get weirder. And totally. Yeah. So
go crazy, Tim Burton. Go crazy.
Yeah.
And stay focused though.
Yeah. All right. Well, if you're out there, let us know what you thought about this episode. Let us know what you'd like to hear us do an episode about. This is a new show. So if you're just here, we're getting people in our comments who are going like, oh man, where can I get more episodes of this? And it's like, we're getting them out as quickly as we can right now. You're here at the beginning. You're here at the beginning of a brand new thing. How fun. Let us know what you'd like to hear us talk about, you know?
Yeah, and I mean, we both try to comment on YouTube, so go over there and we'll tell us what you think, and tell especially about this movie. I mean, it's doing well at the box office, but I really want to know what people thought about it, because I haven't been able to talk to many people about it. So tell us what you thought. Did you like it? Did you love it? If you're a Tim Burton fan, or if you're not a Tim Burton fan, let us know.
Yep. All right, everybody, we'll see you on the next one. Beetlejuice, 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 and the guy from Ferris Bueller just appeared in my room again. I need to stop doing that.
Go away.
Go away, dude.
Go away.
You've committed.
Home.
You're a sex criminal. Go away.
We don't want you here anymore.
Home, you. Okay. Bye, everybody. See you next time. Easy.